And welcome to the Road to Genome podcast. This episode is being brought to you from St Mary's Hospital, part of the Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust in central London. I'm your host, Helen Bethel, genetic counsellor and podcast host for the North Eastern Yorkshire Genomic Medicine Service. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dame Janice Sigsworth, Chief Nursing Officer. So thanks so much for joining us, Janice. It's lovely to have you with us on the podcast.
Thank you.
So can I start by asking you, what is your current job title or titles?
Yeah, thank you. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Imperial College Healthcare Trust.
Okay.
That's a large five-site acute trust in Northwest London.
Mm-hmm. And so what does that job entail?
Oh, that's a tricky one. It's got a variety of aspects. My main role is to sit on our most senior management board of the mm-hmm. organisation and to give advice on quality and safety aspects of patient care, and also to advise our board on professional nursing and midwifery standards. In addition to leading our nursing and midwifery workforce, we've got about 4,500 wow. nurses and midwives and healthcare support workers mm-hmm. at Imperial. It's a wonderful job, yeah. And I wouldn't swap it for anything.
That's fantastic to hear you. You're so passionate and enjoy it so much. So, as a child, was this always what you wanted to do?
It wasn't really, no. I came to nursing quite late on in my late teens, when I was 16, 17. Mm-hmm. I'd looked at a few other possibilities in the police force, mm-hmm. Teaching. Mm-hmm. And one of my secret aspirations, although I've never managed it, was to be a spy.
Oh, really?
although actually being a nurse, you are a little bit of a spy anyway. But when I got to 17, I, like most children at that age, had to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And I'd studied biology and sociology for my A-levels, and they seemed very naturally to bring me towards a career and application to study nursing.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned being a spy in nursing. Yeah. What can you tell us more about that?
Well, quite a lot of the work that we do, certainly in my career, working very closely with patients and their families, it's a very positive thing, I think, mm-hmm. that you're looking for changes in terms of signs and symptoms, mm-hmm. both physically and emotionally, mm-hmm. as you help patients and their families through quite difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not what you're told, it's what you see,
yeah.
what you observe,
yeah.
That make the difference, really. Yeah. And then how you take that
yeah.
back into the interactions with the patients and the families.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap. I often think of it in kind of detective work, in that trying to kind of look for the clues and put them together and give you that kind
yeah,
of
evidence.
Yeah,
no, that's absolutely yeah. that's absolutely right. There was an interesting case when I was a ward sister, and our professor of medicine came mm-hmm. to see a patient, and no one quite knew what was wrong mm. with them. And he took all the blood results and all the observations that we'd been taking and listened to all the symptoms. And by piecing all of that together, he was able to make a diagnosis that had escaped everyone else.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And does nursing run in the family?
It doesn't, I'm afraid. No, no. I don't think there are any other nurses in my family. I'm very proud that my niece, though, is currently at Leeds studying speech and language therapy.
Yeah.
And my daughter and my son, having tried to influence them heavily to join healthcare, neither are kind of leaning that way at the moment. But all my mum says to me is that, oh, well, when people weren't very well, they used to come to your grandmother for advice. Oh,
okay.
But she wasn't a nurse, but clearly had quite a bit of experience in helping people who weren't very well.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe had that same drive that you mentioned about kind of wanting to work with people. And
probably, and, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, probably. Probably. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's not in the yeah. family.
So what was your journey like from being 17 and choosing nursing to today? What kind of twists and turns have you taken? Have you gone into any particular area of nursing?
Yeah. So, well, I left Yorkshire to come to London to train to be a nurse many, many years ago. And that was, you know, it took us, in those days, it took about 7 hours to make that journey one mm. way. And I trained at one of the hospitals in our current group, mm-hmm. And I've worked in London all of my career. And very early on, I found a ward when I was on placement that I really, really enjoyed, a respiratory ward, so heart and lung conditions. Mm-hmm. And I liked that particular ward because it had a very strong ethos on education, mm-hmm. a very strong ethos on outstanding clinical practice and on research.
Mm-hmm.
And it integrated all of those three mm-hmm. within nursing, but also across the multidisciplinary team. Mm-hmm. So we were very integrated into quite a lot of the medical research mm-hmm. and quite a lot of the allied health professions research. So it was a very vibrant environment to work in.
Yeah.
And I learned something new every day mm-hmm. as a student. And as a consequence of that, I persuaded them to take me back to be a staff nurse there.
Yeah.
Where I worked for 2 or 3 years. I went off for more senior roles in cardiothoracic mm-hmm. surgery mm-hmm. so that I could learn a little bit more about the patient's mm-hmm. journey. We tended to look after patients at the end of their life, mm-hmm. But often they'd had cardiothoracic surgery before they arrived with us. Mm-hmm. So it was really helpful to see some of the experiences and some of the surgical operations that they'd been through before they came back to us. And I eventually... that ward I started off on, I eventually became the sister mm-hmm. of that ward and the senior nurse. And then our general manager was going off to a promotion and he said, you could do my job. And I said, oh, no, I couldn't. It was all kind of numbers and business management and marketing and strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, let me put you through your paces and then you can apply and let's see if you get it. And he did. And I did get the job. It was quite a big change from my clinical nursing career, where I was supporting the business management of managing the money and the finances,
mm-hmm.
managing the outpatients and getting the patients in and getting them treated, but also still leading the clinical aspects of care, which was a great opportunity for me
mm-hmm.
To expand and develop. And with hindsight, it's really helped me then with my next steps in my career. At the time,
mm-hmm.
It felt like an incredibly steep learning curve each day, which was fun but stressful at times.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I went off to 2 or 3 different hospitals in London,
mm-hmm.
taking the next step mm-hmm. to be a divisional nurse director and then a nurse director. Mm-hmm. And I've been a chief nursing officer for over 20 years now.
Wow.
In various guises. I've spent a little bit of time at the Department of Health, where I was the Deputy Chief Nurse for England.
Yeah.
And also within a health authority where I commissioned nursing and midwifery education, which again I enjoyed. I think what I'd say about my career is that I have enjoyed every day of it.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, nursing fit me like a glove.
Yeah.
And it's enabled me to do really well in my career,
mm-hmm.
but to enjoy it, it's never felt like work.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the advice I give my children. Find something you absolutely love that they'll pay you for.
Yeah.
You'll go far.
Yeah. That's incredible to hear you having enjoyed it so much and be so passionate about
it. I know. I feel
it.
Very lucky to have found a job. I've talked to lots of people, you know, in my life, both in healthcare and out of healthcare, and not mm-hmm. everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Some days, obviously, are better than others. And occasionally, there have been days when I wanted to mm-hmm. pat my bag
mm-hmm.
And leave and never come back. Mm-hmm. But generally, those are in the minority.
Yeah. And can you think of a case from your clinical years that has maybe stayed with you over your years into more senior positions that maybe still gives you drive today?
Yeah, there's one, which one of many really, but one, two probably. I'll do one and then I'll maybe do the second one. The first one was where I was a ward sister actually, and I met a lady who was waiting for a heart transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never had any inclination to donate any of my organs.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in her 50s and working with her and looking after her and her family, mm-hmm. she had younger children and a husband and mm-hmm. all of that. Working with her and watching her disability with a failing heart
mm-hmm.
and the problems that brought both to her daily living but mm-hmm. to her worrying and her family worrying she could die at any moment mm-hmm. if she didn't get the heart transplant. Mm-hmm. It was 1987. And I remember that because I went shortly after looking after her, and she did indeed get a heart transplant. I went and got a donor card, and I've still got that donor card. Mm-hmm. And I still remember the lady's name. Yeah, in 1987. And, you know, on the card, I think you do it all electronically now, agreed to donate all my organs and my and parts of my eyes as mm-hmm. well. And following that, I kind of have a really good sense of, I suppose, what donation brings to families. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite an advocate now in our own organisation and with family and friends that I meet about mm-hmm. about donating organs mm-hmm. To the NHS so that they can be, you know, used for people mm-hmm. who really mm-hmm. have a very poor quality of life and their own life's in danger mm-hmm. If they don't get the transplantation. And at Imperial, we run a large kidney transplantation service mm-hmm. Where we take family, friends or matches mm-hmm. and do kidney transplants into patients mm-hmm. who are in our dialysis service. Mm-hmm. And now I see now with kidneys how effective and how transforming mm-hmm. That can be. So that's one example. And the second example was with a young chap who's dying of AIDS. Mm-hmm. My ward in the 1980s was a respiratory ward, usually with older people who had smoking-related illnesses. Mm-hmm. But during the AIDS epidemic, the ward pretty much transformed over 2 or 3 months to take large numbers of young gay men mm-hmm. with AIDS-related pneumonias, as well as other people with that mm-hmm. condition. And looking after those young men mm-hmm. and seeing them die in the early days, now the transformation in treatment and medicines means that people with HIV mm-hmm. live healthy-ish lives now, mm-hmm. Live healthy lives now. Was very impactful. I'd not looked after a lot of people who died so at such a young age. Mm-hmm. And really being with them and their families and going through that journey with them and supporting them through that journey mm-hmm. really gave me, I suppose, an insight into how to help and support families who are losing mm-hmm. loved ones who are younger. Mm-hmm. That's something now that when we talk about clinical care and we talk about the role of the nurse, that being there with the patient and their family mm-hmm. is something I always do bring back to the forefront, because mm-hmm. quite a lot's changed in society in the time that mm-hmm. I've been a nurse. You know, technically everything's keyhole surgery mm-hmm. and there's a lot of artificial intelligence used in reading results. And in fact, these days you get your results back to your phone before mm-hmm. your doctor gets them. Mm-hmm. But what's not changed is what patients and families want when they're going through difficult times, that compassionate care, that mm-hmm. holding of the hand, mm-hmm. that support through the journey. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to, as I do often in my own organisation or in this role, large groups of nurses, I talk about the importance of that.
Yes.
Still being absolutely central yeah. to what nurses and nurses need to be thinking of mm-hmm. with patients and their families. And I forget who it was that said it, but it's not, you know, what you do, it's how you leave the person feeling when you yes. do it that's important. And that's really been there throughout my whole career. And if you look back further into nursing history, which I have done, you know, it was very evident even in Florence Nightingale's days in the Crimean yeah. mm-hmm. War that mm-hmm. that's what people needed. That's yeah. what those soldiers needed, yeah. someone to be with them.
Yeah, and I hear you with that. You know, as a genetic counsellor, I think we have the absolute privilege of often not even working with an individual, but working with several members of a family yeah. and being able to give that compassion and care through what is a difficult journey with them, with not just yes. one individual, but linking all that together.
Yeah, I mean, primarily, you know, as a nurse, it's the patient and you're with them at the bedside and you're with them, you know, on that 24/7 journey while they're yeah. with you in hospital or if you're looking after them in the community. But when someone is ill, we all know ourselves in our family, it mm-hmm. has an impact, mm-hmm.
of course.
Different impact across the generation mm-hmm. of the family, mm-hmm. but also on the people that are close mm-hmm. to that person in the family. And they have their own grief and their own emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. that you need to be thinking about and supporting as well, because they're the people that then can support the person going through the treatment or the care.
So can you remember the first time you heard the term genetics or genomics then?
I don't know, actually. Lots of people have asked me, well, lots of people have said to me about the role that I've got, which is the National Professional Lead for Genomics in Nursing and Midwifery. You know, thank goodness it's you. And I thought, oh, I wonder why they said that. I was expecting a sort of three-headed dog like in Harry Potter to leap out of the floorboards. And I think it's probably because people don't kind of know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And it's a fearful thing. They think, oh, God, that's sort of science. And I don't really know what they're talking about. I'm just tracking back. I think it's probably earlier on in my career when we were learning about things like breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Where genetic changes had brought around particular illnesses. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the one that would have been one of the first places that I knew that if you had some genetic changes, mm-hmm. it might mean you were more predisposed to breast cancer than not, I think. And then my ex-partner has hypercholesterolemia. And so we wondered whether that, and what I knew about that was that, you know, they had to take statins and it was hereditary. Mm-hmm. And so when our children were born, we were thinking, we wonder if they've got it. Mm. And if they had, because those statins started at, you know, kind of age 9, 10. Mm-hmm. And if they had, we wondered whether they would need to start treatment. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking when they were 12, 13, oh, we better make some contact with the GP surgery. And lo and behold, they must have read my mind, because a letter came from the GP surgery saying, we need to check out if your children have got hypercholesterolemia. Mm-hmm. And so we had to sit down and talk to them about what that was and what it would mean for them. Mm-hmm. And off they went for a blood test. Mm-hmm. And we all sat waiting for the blood test to come back. I think that, interestingly, they were quite worried, I think, about it, because they were worried they were going to have to take their statins early on. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have the full-blown hypercholesterolemia from the genetic testing, so they're not on statins. Mm-hmm. But clearly, when they choose their partners and when they have children, it'll be something we'll talk to them about. Mm-hmm. So those two examples are probably, the first occasions that I came across
genomics. And how did you find that experience for you as a parent going through that process with your children? You mentioned that they were anxious. How did you find it as a parent?
It was hard, I think, because it was something that you're passing on to your children, not particularly me, but my partner at the time was passing on to our children with no control over it. So there was that element of it. And then I'm always very mindful, I suppose, of what I know about compliance in children and young adults on taking medication. And I know they don't really take it very often through the work that I've done in diabetes. So I was thinking, oh, goodness, if they're going to have to take a pill every day, I'm going to have to keep an eye on them to take it, because likely as not, they'll forget, or they won't want to take it. They won't want to seem like they're ill. And how will we help them explain that to their friends and then to their partners in future? So it was quite complicated, I think. And managing their worry about it. So, you know, let's take each day at a time. You've had the test. There's only a 1 in 3, a 1 in 4, 1 in 6 chance that it will be you. So let's have the test. Let's see where you get to. If you have got it, it's really important to find out early on because the implications of heart disease and how it might affect you earlier in your life than most people. You know, we need to make sure that we keep you as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And I suppose in terms of my general experience with genomics and why my general experience around genomics and why I think it's important are that it will help people live healthier lives for longer. Because you know what you need to do earlier and you don't run into an illness or a sudden death without knowing why. So you can plan ahead and take the steps that keep you healthy for longer.
So obviously you mentioned doing your cardiothoracic work from kind of late 80s And so really genomics kind of came into more common practice, kind of more late 90s onwards. Was there ever a case in your clinical workload that you can think of where genetics or genomics was questioned or raised?
Not that I can recall. Not that I can recall. What I do recall, and when I've talked to some of the nurse leaders in genomics, the clinical nurse leaders, they say, well, to me, they say, well, it's quite simple, really. It's about history taking.
Yeah.
They say, you know, when you're taught how to take history, and I sat there saying, yeah. And they said, well, do you say, what did your mum die of? What did your dad die of? And I say, yeah. And they said, well, those questions that you were asking then. And I went, you're absolutely right, because I knew why I was asking them. Yep. I knew I was asking them because what your mum or your dad died of might influence what you died of.
Yep.
But I didn't really have that golden thread of, oh, that's a genomics question.
Yes. Yeah.
But as I've understood genomics more and talked with more patients and families and more specialists in genomics, I was like, oh, right, yes, that's absolutely why I was asking them. And now when I talk to large groups of nurses, which is part of my role, really, to demystify genomics and to come at it from a sense of, hey, I knew nothing about this 5, 10 years ago. I really didn't. And I couldn't quite piece together how it went through my career. Do you take a history? And they all nod. And I say, well, when I talk to specialist nurses in genomics, this is what they told me about taking a history. So I'd always said, you know, and have you got any brothers and sisters? And they'd say, oh yeah, two sisters, but you know, one of them's died. And you'd always say, well, what did they die of?
Yeah.
So things like breast cancer, heart disease, hypertension, stroke were always things that you would jot down. And then I guess someone more clinically focused than me or more senior than me might look at them.
Like
some of the senior nurses or some of the professors of medicine and think, oh, right, that's the golden thread.
Yeah.
That's the link to genomics.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it came about in my career. So with hindsight, it was there.
Yeah. Almost hidden in plain sight.
I think so. Yeah. And I think the way we talk about it now is very different.
Yeah.
And there's much more awareness. And we all do, don't we? If we've got something wrong with us, we have a quick Google. And you go in to see your GP, if you're me, with your little Google search. And the GP will say, oh, yeah, everyone comes in with a Google search. No, you've not got that condition. Yeah. It might look like you have, but you've not.
Yeah.
And you are trying to sort of cross-reference and check.
Yeah.
With your family members, and my family are a very ordinary family in the north of England. You know, my mum got a bit of gout. She's in her 90s. She got a bit of gout, and then what I've noticed in the last 2 years is my brother is in his 50s. He's got a bit of gout, and I was thinking to myself, oh, I wonder if that's genetic.
Yeah.
Thinking then to myself, I wonder if I'm going to get a bit of gout. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it's their lifestyle and my mum's age.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And I thought, oh, I better have a little check of that to see if it is. Because those sort of family similarities are so much more prevalent than I'd ever thought.
Absolutely. And it's natural,
we're getting older.
It's natural to look to your family to kind of guide your predictions of what you think you might happen. And, you know, genomics doesn't always provide all of the answers. You know, I've lost count the number of times I've maybe seen a family and said, you know, you don't need me to tell you that this is familial. You can see it in your family, but we just can't pinpoint exactly what that is.
Yeah.
You know, because it's...
Yeah. Well, the two things in my family, I'm older now and my hair is still not grey.
Yeah.
And my mum said, oh, my hair didn't go grey.
Yeah.
Till I was 70 or 80. And I think, oh, right. But interestingly, on the male side of my family, they're all grey very early.
Yeah.
So that I'm hoping now with my mum living till 90, I'll be kind of sailing on happily and fitly into my 90s.
Yeah.
It's made me a bit more aware of all of that.
Hi, my name's Naima Kalachand and I'm the host of Behind the Genes, Genomics England's podcast. Join us for the latest in cutting-edge research and real-life stories from people affected by rare conditions and cancer. Through thoughtful conversations, we'll take you behind the science. Plus check out our Genomics 101 explainer episodes, where we break down complex genetic terms in under 10 minutes. Subscribe to Behind the Genes on your favourite podcast app today.
So can you tell me more about your role for championing genomics in nursing and midwifery?
Yeah, my current role is the National Professional Lead for Nursing and Midwifery and Genomics. And my job really is to bring what I call genomics to the masses. Mm-hmm. You know, there are over 500,000 nurses and midwives in England, and in the UK, something like 700,000. And genomics touches the lives of many, many nurses and midwives directly in their work, particularly the specialist nurses in the areas where we've had genomic advances. And they're very familiar. They're very well educated. They know what they're talking about. They know what tests are available. They know how to explain that to patients, and they know who then to refer them to or how to signpost them. My job really is to reach the hundreds and thousands of general nurses and midwives who work every day in clinical practice with patients and their families in a more general way, not in a specialist way. And I kind of feel I'm very well suited to do that because I'm a general nurse and I can say I don't know a lot about it, but I do know this, the history taking. I do know that lots of things do get passed down from one family member to another to another. So I talk about it, I think, in ways that demystify genomics and in ways that can relate directly to their clinical practice. So my job is to do that. In terms of awareness sessions, in my own clinical work with nurses and midwives, and to help others do that across the country, and to then bring in for areas that they're interested in specialists, whether it be genetic counsellors or specialist nurses or specialist midwives. What I have noticed is that in midwifery, the midwives are more aware of genetic testing, and that's because in antenatal screening we've had genetic testing for a long time. With my children, you know, 20 years ago they pricked the heel and were doing some genetic tests that they told us about when they, you know, did the tests. So every midwife will be aware of the antenatal testing. We've got more sophisticated. We've just had a new study launched across the NHS testing babies at birth for a whole raft of additional changes in the genome. And I think that's a really good example of where many more midwives and many more patients and their families and babies are having genomics and genetics influence and impact on their lives, so that we can now find changes much earlier on. I've heard lots of stories from mums and children about, well, the baby wasn't quite right, and there were some either physical changes or some emotional developmental changes, and no one quite knew what it was all about. And then eventually a test came about and they had the test and they found that yes, they had a very rare disease or very rare condition that might only affect a handful of people in this country, but it put an explanation to all the changes that they'd seen as the child was growing up. And to identify that earlier now, I believe, is very helpful to that child and that family, because they can then start to understand and put in place changes that might help the child developmentally or help the child physically, and not be thinking, we don't know what this is, the child's just not thriving.
So which bits of your current role do you enjoy the most?
I think the bits that I've enjoyed the most have been twofold, really. One is taking the message out to nurses and midwives more generally. We've done a couple of seminars online where we've had, you know, 1,000 nurses and midwives join, and just getting that message out to as many nurses and midwives as possible. And I think the other bit coupled with that has been hearing back from those nurses and midwives, hearing their stories, hearing their challenges, so that we can take those challenges and try and mm-hmm. create other opportunities for them to come together to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And also hearing their successes and hearing some of the stories from patients and their families. That's been really rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really liked doing that across England. Mm-hmm. And I think the other bit I do enjoy is the sort of policy creation.
Mm-hmm.
So influencing the government
mm-hmm.
and influencing nursing and midwifery policy
mm-hmm.
through the Nursing and Midwifery Council regulations. Mm-hmm. We were really successful in getting elements of genomics education
mm-hmm.
into the undergraduate curriculum for nurses and midwives. And I was very pleased that we managed to do that. And we also managed to get them into the nursing associate curriculum. And about 6-7 months ago, we invited a couple of nursing associates to come and talk at one of the sessions. And I was amazed with how much they knew about genomics and genetics.
Yeah.
And I was thrilled that, you know, sitting in a meeting, which can be dull sometimes, thinking you're making a difference and then seeing the difference that you'd made.
That's incredible.
So I love that kind of taking the theory into practice,
I suppose.
And that really links back to the reason that I like the job that I have.
Yeah.
Because at Imperial, I can take some of the theory around education and research
mm-hmm.
into clinical practice.
Yeah, absolutely. What is needed, that kind of, you know, increasing the education from the very start of a career, you know, and again, you know, in the teaching that I've done with nurses, again, is kind of very similar to you, demystifying and saying this is, you're already doing a lot of this.
Yeah.
It's just relabeling it and recognizing it and just spotting the red flags and knowing when to, kind of bring that family history to the top of the of your detective list of what you're of the clues that you are collecting. Sometimes you can discount it as necessary, you know, unnecessary as part of the picture you see, but sometimes that family history actually needs to be at the top of the clue list that there's something more going on, and that's when that is genomics.
Yeah, and that links very much, I think, to my case, the sort of case studies with the children.
Yeah.
To see mums and dads
mm-hmm.
talk about how stressed and anxious and worried they were for their mm-hmm. child, not really knowing what was going on. And then one mum talked about getting the diagnosis and they all just went, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness we now know
mm-hmm.
what's going on and we can do something about it.
Yeah.
And
we heard that firsthand with some of the other episodes that we've recorded of patients that have been through that diagnostic odyssey journey and the difficulty and the challenges of that until genomics does give them an answer, even when it's a very difficult answer, actually just giving them some certainty of why this is happening and giving them a little bit of an indication of what a prognosis, you know, might be.
Yeah, something to work with, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the other great thing I think about genomics is that we can now target treatments.
Mm-hmm.
So a colleague of mine who had breast cancer had her genome sequenced, and it transpired that the conventional treatment for her mm-hmm. type of breast cancer
mm-hmm.
wouldn't be very effective.
Mm-hmm.
So she was spared some quite strong chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was spared probably a hospitalisation and several trips to the hospital, mm-hmm. quite a bit of time off work.
Mm-hmm.
And she was moved over into another treatment stream mm-hmm. that was more likely to be effective for her.
Yeah.
So from a sort of patient experience perspective, brilliant.
Yes.
But also from a value for money perspective,
yes.
brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, genomics makes us more efficient
mm-hmm.
and absolutely. More productive.
Yeah.
And I think anything in healthcare that helps that means mm-hmm. that we get to treat more patients.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she didn't have that chemo, which meant the next person it would work for could have that chemo.
Yeah.
And I think that's another important feature. If we know that certain painkillers don't work for patients,
mm-hmm.
we can give different painkillers.
Yeah.
So the whole kind of experience for patients, from what I've seen and heard,
is
really enhanced.
Yeah.
The only area we've kind of come across, certainly in the awareness sessions and the discussions with nurses and midwives, is around future prognosis that mm-hmm. you've touched on, and particularly around things like dementia
mm-hmm.
and Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've still more work to do on mm-hmm. understanding how we test for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, would I want to know is my mm-hmm. question. If in 10 years' time I was going to get Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm.
would I want to know if I was going to get it, or would I just want to quite happily and merrily carry on? Because some of those conditions we now know are inherited.
Yeah.
And I think there are more sort of ethical dilemmas that we need to work through in our society, certainly in the UK, to understand how we best do those tests, how we prepare people for them, and how we prepare people for the outcome of them. Because some conditions would mean in breast cancer, if you've got the BRCA gene, well, you might have surgery, breast removal, etc. That to me seems slightly more easier to get your head around for me as a person than you're going to have dementia or Alzheimer's
where there's no cure.
Five or 10 years when there's no cure,
And I have to say, it's great to hear that you do have those ethical concerns and you do have those questions with being at such a pivotal point in embedding things for nursing and midwives, that those cautions are still kind of there for you. Because as a genetic counsellor, that's what we do when we do take people through genetic testing. Yeah. And it is one of those concerns about genomics going out into mainstream, is that this is a kind of runaway train that runs away without us kind of embedding that ethics that we've so long kept in our practice. So it's great to hear that, although you are, you know, so positive about what genomics can bring, you also, on the flip side, have the caution.
Absolutely.
You know, when you're, you know, kind of, you know, preaching the greatness of genomics, you also have that kind of leveling of it that, you know, it does need to be treated with caution.
I think the ethical dilemmas and the caution is important in any genetic test, whether it's can be treated or not, and not treated. And those questions come up quite a lot.
Yeah.
They come up quite a lot from my counterparts across the country. And when we're in a very mixed group of nurses and midwives, staff nurses, sisters, matrons, a hand will always go up to ask that ethical question about, well, how do you prepare people? How do you help them when it's not treatable?
Yeah.
And I think it's a really, really important feature of mainstreaming genomics into nursing and midwifery, because most of the nurses and midwives that patients will come and families will come into contact with won't have a level of expertise that can mean they can counsel on these aspects. But what they need to be able to do absolutely is know who can.
Yeah. Exactly.
Or know how to start and how to refer someone to someone who can have those conversations with them in a more focused, productive and often ongoing way, I think.
And you mentioned, you made reference to the generation study earlier about that testing of newborns. And I think one of the most interesting things of that piece of work is actually the work that they've done with the public in terms of gathering public opinion about acceptance of this use of this kind of technology in that context. And it's certainly one of the things that I'm most looking forward to seeing is as the kind of that research continues, as that study is run, is what is the experience of the families going through that?
Yeah.
I think I think it's just great that they are, you know, embedding so much of that public opinion research into that study.
Yeah, it's interesting, that study, because I didn't, one of the reasons I think I do this role so well is because I don't really purport to be an expert in any of it. And so I'm bringing it, as I've said, in language that general nurses and midwives will be able to understand and reflect on how it impacts on them in practice. Equally with patients and their families, it's we've got to talk in a way that they would understand as well. But that generation study, I did read up a little bit on, because I heard about it.
Yeah.
Then I discovered, oh, it's happening in my trust in Imperial. And I thought, oh, I'll have a little read of this. And I did have that ethical stuff in my head, thinking if that were my baby, would I want to go into it and would I want to know the outcome of it? And I thought, how are they going to prepare people and how are they going to, how are we going to explain what the outcomes were? So I read up quite a bit about the engagement with the, with the public, about how they put the study together. And I read about how they each step of the way had engaged with the public to create a pathway that was thought to be the most supportive to families and babies. And that seemed to me to be a really good blueprint for how we might continue to engage mm-hmm. with the public mm-hmm. as we move forward with genetic yeah. testing, because the speed at which it's moving mm-hmm. is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it will touch, if it hasn't already, if you look around, it's probably touched your life, but if it hasn't already, it will.
Mm-hmm.
Not too far into the future, it'll yeah. touch your life.
Yeah. So on the flip side of what is the most rewarding part of your job, what do you find the most challenging?
The role I have, which is a national professional lead for nursing and midwifery role, I do in tandem with my chief nursing officer at Imperial. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish I had a few more days in my week
yeah.
to spend certainly getting the message out mm-hmm. across England to nurses and midwives.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the challenge. Getting enough people together in the way that we need to because of the size and scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big challenges of the role has been the size and scale of the nursing and midwifery mm-hmm. workforce. As I say, I think midwifery, it's genomics and genetics much more embedded
mm-hmm.
into the undergrad curriculum,
mm-hmm.
into postgraduate curriculum and into practice because mm-hmm. of the antenatal and postnatal screening mm-hmm. that's been embedded for a long time. In nursing, there are so many specialties.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much bigger group,
mm-hmm.
hundreds of thousands of nurses who work in different specialties. And each of the specialties has their own genetic mm-hmm. test, their own pathway for patients,
mm-hmm.
their own process for diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It's very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been the challenge in nursing particularly.
Mm-hmm.
How we've tackled some of that is focusing on some of the more common
mm-hmm.
Genetic changes and some of the more common tests
mm-hmm.
and in some of the areas where we have more patients tested
mm-hmm.
to try and get the message out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the size and scale of the nursing workforce that's been yeah. the challenge.
Yeah. So looking to the future, what do you think is the most exciting bit of genomics that's coming down the road?
The most exciting developments in the future for me are probably twofold. We don't know what we don't know,
mm-hmm.
so we don't know what discovery will be made
yeah.
tomorrow or the next day
yeah.
or the next
very
day.
True, yeah.
And I would like really to be able to go out into any clinical area, community, primary care, hospital where there are nurses and go and chat to them and for them to have some understanding. That's yeah. my other big challenge, I think. We've got challenges in our population
mm-hmm.
In the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
We've got issues with diabetes, issues with obesity
mm-hmm.
and all the additional problems, particularly mm-hmm. obesity brings, coupled with drug and alcohol related mm-hmm. problems. And I would really like to see some genomics work
mm-hmm.
beginning to help with tackling some of those mm-hmm. inequalities,
mm-hmm.
the health inequalities that we yeah. have, that really make people bring people to be much iller and give mm-hmm. people other conditions
mm-hmm.
secondary
yeah.
to drug and alcohol or obesity
mm-hmm.
that would help promote health
mm-hmm.
in the population. Those are all kind of physical things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether there'll be a genetic test help with emotional aspects of those conditions I've
yeah.
described, but I'd kind of like to see them come together.
Yeah. And for you then, Janice, where do you think your ambition will take you next?
For me, we're developing a nursing midwifery framework
mm-hmm.
To embed genomics into nursing and midwifery practice.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see that finalised
mm-hmm.
and launched.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see some of the ambition we've got in there
mm-hmm.
realised. And I'd like to hand it over, I think,
yeah,
to my successor.
Yeah.
In a good place with a good platform
mm-hmm.
to build on and take forward. I'm very proud, really, of what we've achieved in the regions mm-hmm. who are leading on mm-hmm. some of the genomics work. We've got a sort of stellar cast, really, of nurses and midwives regionally who are heading up this work. And I know one or two of them. I've done podcasts with you. They're amazing. They're outstanding mm-hmm. individuals.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see that all of that built on as we move forward.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Janice. It's been fantastic to talk to you and hear your story. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to hear more information about the topics that we've discussed today, then you can find these on our website, www.ney-genomics.org.uk
www.genesis.com/podcasts, where you'll also find all the episodes in our podcast series. These can also be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.